I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama will spend this week hopscotching around the country stumping for Democrats, but only in places where he won 2 years ago, not where Democrats up for re-election are struggling the most now. And by week's end, lawmakers in Congress will wrap up their business and join him in heading for the campaign trail, passing a measure to keep the government running through the end of the month before they go. Anti-government anger has already brought down 7 incumbents in primaries. It's changing the political calculus daily. So let's check in with Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News. And Rick, we know that Republicans have been gaining momentum, but you say 7 Democratic seats that ABC listed as toss-ups just last week are now also leaning Republican. Where are they, and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, these are seats in Florida, in Ohio, in Virginia that have been tipping for some time, but now we're able to classify it a little bit differently. Right now, we're looking at a landscape where we can say 199 seats are pretty safe for the Democrats, 191 pretty safe for the Republicans, so almost even there. That means that the balance of the election is going to be determined in just 45 seats. Now, the critical thing here, 42 of those 45 are held by Democrats, so Democrats are fighting almost entirely on their own turf, playing defense across the country.
Well, but there has been some new movement towards Democrats.
That's right, and particularly in the Senate side, well, they've got some positive news. The Delaware race, because Christine O'Donnell, the Tea Party candidate, won that nomination, that is now likely to be something that the Democrats can hold on to, where they're also a little bit more optimistic about their chances in California and in Washington State in particular. But it's still going to be so difficult for them to just hold on to things. Right now, we do think it's probably more likely than not that Democrats hold on to power in the Senate. But again, this is defense. This is about playing defense everywhere.
Well, let's stay in the Senate, and let's stay with Republican Christine O'Donnell of Delaware. Bill Maher keeps releasing clips of her appearances from the 90s on his show. In one released this past weekend, she calls evolution a myth. And then in the opening skit of Saturday Night Live, O'Donnell, played by Christine Wiig, goes to the Republican National Committee to reassure nervous strategists who've been asking her repeatedly if there's anything in her past that might come up.
This race is going to tighten up, and when it does, it's going to be a real dogfight. You need to understand that.
Look, please don't try to tell me about dogfights, okay? I know all about dogfights. For your information, gentlemen, I used to run a business staging dogfights.
She then goes on to admit burning down someone's house for revenge and gets on a broom and flies off. But, you know, Ira Glass in his This American Life program this week said that, you know, this strategy of painting herself as the attacked one is working for Christine O'Donnell. What's your sense?
That's what worked for her during the primary. There was a pretty extraordinary automatic phone call that Sarah Palin did for her at the very end. People were attacking her record on her own personal tax returns, her truthfulness on things, and Sarah Palin said, look, I know what it's like to have the establishment try to bring me down with malicious attacks. You undercut all of your critics with one fell swoop like that, and it makes it very difficult to tar a candidate if they're saying, look, I'm just trying to be brought down by powers that be, folks that just want to upend my candidacy. You reach a point of saturation with some of these things that come out. Yes, she's said and done some out of the ordinary things, but if she continues to say and has her supporters say, look, this is just the mainstream media or just liberals trying to bring down a true conservative, it's a tough thing to rebut. It actually could actually make her stronger.
Well, let's take a quick look at the House side. Here in Massachusetts, a longtime Congressman Barney Frank brought in Bill Clinton over the weekend to stump for Frank in his race against a political neophyte, a 35-year-old Republican named Sean Bilott. But Republicans are also looking closely at what they see as a maybe more realistic opportunity to grab a formerly Democratic seat. This is the race in which DA, a Democrat, William Keating, is running against a self-proclaimed Tea Partier, Jeff Perry, for William Delahunt's vacated seat, Delahunt not running again. And Jeff Perry, a Tea Partier, but he said he doesn't want help from Sarah Palin. How much are people looking at that race?
That's a critical one, and it's the type of race that Republicans really need to pick up if they're gonna have a chance to really build their majority. It's a district that has always had Republican possibilities. Republicans have long eyed that Cape and Islands and up through the South Shore district and said, "There's one where we can do some damage." But it's tough to run against an incumbent. They have an opening. This is the kind of year where things like that can happen. So I do think it's on Republicans' radar screen very much.
Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News, host of the political webcast Top Line. Thanks as always.
Hey, thank you.
One of the hallmarks of the beginning of schizophrenia is psychosis, hallucinations, delusions. And now there is new thinking that young people, as young as 13, should be screened to find out if they might be genetically predisposed to have psychotic episodes so they can be made aware of possible triggers. And not only that, if a child starts displaying symptoms, doctors believe early intervention can lessen the effects. This is stunning news for many of us. Full disclosure, just 10 years ago, a beloved relative had what's called a first break, hearing voices, feeling paranoid. At that time, a social worker told us to just say goodbye to him, and he did get progressively worse until we intervened. So we're eager to hear more today about the idea of intervening to prevent small psychotic episodes and stave off bigger ones. Corinne Cather is a clinical psychologist at the First Episode and Early Psychosis Program, FEPP, at Mass General Hospital here in Boston. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Describe this emerging field.
Sure. In recent years, the United States has realized that we are woefully behind other countries in terms of educating the public, doing things like public service announcements to alert people to early warning signs of psychosis. A tremendous departure from how we think about it. Yeah. Although there have been some campaigns, I saw one in New York, for example, that Glenn Close had gotten behind. Individuals are wearing T-shirts that depict their diagnoses, and their family members or loved ones are putting an arm around the person in Grand Central Station.
Well, so you're talking about, on one level, just public awareness. Letting kids know? I mean, should there be a kind of classroom instruction, or what are you
saying? That would be the question, would be whether or not people should get into education about this and learn what are the early warning signs, what are the symptoms of psychosis, how might you intervene with them.
But then where do you go from there? What does a child do once they know that? Mm-hmm. Doesn't it set them up for just feeling like, oh my gosh, there's a ticking time bomb?
Well, that can happen. And I think the other thing that can happen is even among people who have had a psychotic break, they can become oversensitive and fearful that they're going to re-experience a psychotic break. So sometimes what you're working on is actually decatastrophizing those fears and talking to them about what they can do. So what can someone do? And I should say that the evidence base isn't completely clear on this point. But in terms of thinking about what we know causes psychosis or at least contributes to relapse, likely that person should avoid substances. Use absolutely predisposes people to tip the scales towards psychosis if they have a pre-existing biological vulnerability.
Well, you say tip the scales. Is it true a portion of psychosis can be genetic, but another portion can be a trauma like a head injury or, as you say, the drugs that can then trigger the genetic predisposition?
Exactly. It's an interaction of the two. There aren't genetic tests that tell us this person has a high genetic vulnerability or a low genetic vulnerability. And even the way we think about genes now has really changed. So it's not really this static concept of either you have the gene or you don't have the gene. It has to do with gene expression. And gene expression, whether or not maybe a gene might be seen as turned on or not, has a lot to do with environmental factors.
Well, again, but it would seem to be the same kind of conversation you might have with a child if you know that there's a lot of alcoholism in their background or, you know, any kind of illness they might have more of a predisposition for. You're nodding yes. I mean, it doesn't have to be overly fraught, the conversation.
Exactly. It could just be increasing awareness and thinking about making certain decisions, like reducing stress in the person's life or enhancing coping strategies. So things like maybe therapy in the event of emerging symptoms that aren't of psychosis but of anxiety or depression would be an important maybe buffering, buffering protective function.
Be careful. That may not be the kid that you want to pile on with 10 AP courses if it's making him a wreck.
You're making an excellent point. You know, in this country, there's an expectation that most people will go to college. Even if the person was really struggling in high school, and a lot of times what we'll see is someone who's sent away from home for the first time, you know, it's not probably an accident that psychosis happens when people tend to go away to school. It's the first time they're living on their own. It's the first time they're under that kind of stress and have to live that independently.
And they've got hormones going crazy, more testosterone in the case of guys, and it could trigger it as well.
Absolutely.
So this is some of the education you'd like to see, some of the awareness you'd like to see. But then this idea that you can look for symptoms in kids. How?
there is a lot of debate about this, about whether or not to even do this. But the idea would be to look at attenuated psychotic symptoms. So people who are hearing whispers or having formless visual hallucinations, shadows, mistaken kind of illusions, you know, looking at curtains but seeing something that looks like spiders, that would be an example of an illusion.
Is this something you really hear from kids?
Sure, yeah.
Tell us more about what kids say. And do they say it? I mean, that's the other thing. Will they actually say that they see these things?
The question is whether or not anyone's even asking those questions. I mean, some of that preventative sort of work needs to maybe be done to set the stage for people to be able to talk about this.
That's part of the awareness campaign.
Exactly.
In other words, if you start, hey, you know, if you start hearing things, you're nodding yes. If you start hearing things or seeing things and you know something's not right here, come tell me.
Exactly. Now, the difficulty is that suspiciousness is often one of the psychotic symptoms. And that really is in direct opposition to the idea that people are going to share that information. Although early on they might. Things like coincidences happening in the environment, seeming to get coded messages, like a license plate starts to take on meaning, or the way a person gestures or coughs is suddenly interpreted as having direct meaning to the individual. That's what we call referential thinking. That's often an early warning sign.
Well, the Boston Globe tells a story of an 18-year-old. He was disheveled. He was listening to one CD on repeat. He was spacing out. Mm-hmm. And this alarmed and alerted his mom.
Right. And in that kind of example, what might be happening is that the individual is thinking that the CD has direct reference to him, is sort of speaking to him or speaking about his life or enacting the events of his life in some way. And he gets scared, thinking, how is this information out there?
Other cases where a child might think that the TV is talking to them. But here's the question. How do you know that that's signs of psychosis and not drugs?
Yeah, certainly the drugs need to be ruled out. Although that kind of thinking, it's a matter of symptoms clustering together. When you start to see people reporting hearing voices, also feeling suspicious and paranoid, and the substance use hasn't changed dramatically recently, like they haven't recently increased their use of pot or other substances, it is actually probably a sign that it is psychosis. It may have been triggered or exacerbated or hastened by drug use, but isn't fully explained by the drug use.
Well, now here comes the striking part. Do I understand that you and others now believe that you can either screen kids who might be predisposed to have these kinds of symptoms and maybe, offset them or delay them? And on the other hand, if kids do go into these full-blown symptoms, you might be able to mitigate the effects of them? You're nodding yes.
Yes, exactly. One thing we like to point out is that delaying the onset of psychosis may actually be a very good thing.
Yeah.
If someone can get through school and continue to maintain their relationships and they're already actively engaged in treatment, as you said, maybe we could mitigate the effects of the psychosis once it actually arrives in the event that it does. Now, in terms of the latter,
intervening after symptoms.
Intervening after there has already been symptoms. The problem is that we're not intervening early enough.
That's Corinne Kather of the first episode in early psychosis program at Mass General Hospital here in Boston. Other symptoms, she says, to look for: strange body sensations, the feeling that your brain is bouncing, a sudden diagnosis of attention deficit disorder in older teens. But do doctors really think they can mitigate these long-term effects of psychosis by catching it early? We want to hear more after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about new thinking in the approach to psychosis in kids. These are episodes of hallucinations or delusions that can spiral out into long-term problems. The thinking is to screen young people to see if they might be predisposed, but also intervene early on if they show symptoms. Now, there's a lot of debate about this. For instance, won't this target kids? You know, they'll carry a stigma. But Corinne Kather, a clinical psychologist at the first episode in early psychosis program, FEPP, at Mass General Hospital here in Boston, says part of the new thinking is to treat psychosis like diabetes, to remove the stigma, because catching it early can lessen the long-term effects. Dr. Kather, you were saying we are woefully behind on catching it early. Explain.
What we call the DUP, or the duration of untreated psychosis, ranges from 1 to 2 years in this country. And the goal would be to intervene within weeks. We know that DUP, longer DUP, predicts poor outcomes in people.
Right. But what do you do? Let's say you get them in the first few weeks. What do you do?
Well, treatment of choice is to use antipsychotic medication. And I know there's a lot of debate about the idea of over-medicating
sure.
adolescents, and these are serious medicines. And in fact, I'm a clinical psychologist. I do therapy. But I know that the database isn't very good for therapy in the absence of antipsychotic medication among folks who have psychotic symptoms.
The debate is that there's side effects from antipsychotic medication.
Very real side effects, yeah. Very troubling. Weight gain is one of the probably most troubling. And the key there is also moving to a prevention model, trying to educate people from the beginning. They're going to be hungrier. They're going to want more food.
So people will have to make that, you know, decision with their doctors. But is there also therapy? Is there other work that can be done to alleviate psychosis early
on? Sure, sure. Well, one of the things that we do is we first start to normalize the idea of psychosis, again, without saying it's not serious, but talking about psychosis is on a continuum with anxiety. You know, hardly anyone would debate that someone with an anxiety disorder could learn coping strategies for managing the anxiety. But that's been a little bit more of a leap for people to grasp in this country, that we could do the same thing with psychotic symptoms. It's very well demonstrated at this point that you can teach people about psychosis. And you may not be able to use the therapy to make the symptoms go away, but you can use the therapy to make the symptoms more manageable.
And when we talk about the kind of intervention that's trying to pinpoint people who don't have symptoms but may be candidates, how old are you talking about then?
Then you're intervening very young, 13 to 17.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of therapy is it? The kind of therapy that you do, for instance, with these kids, what is it?
The recommendation is to do cognitive behavioral therapy.
What does that mean?
Cognitive behavioral therapy looks at the way in which problematic styles of thinking, such as I'm a failure, I'm never going to accomplish anything because I have a psychotic disorder, or hearing voices that say these kinds of things and responding with the belief, I can't handle these voices are never going to go away. Those would be beliefs that you would use specific techniques in cognitive behavioral therapy to modify to beliefs that are more adaptive and probably more accurate.
So in other words, let's learn how to live with that voice.
Exactly, exactly. That would be one modification. Another place would be looking at behavioral patterns. So a very common pattern is for folks to become avoidant when they become anxious. So individuals with paranoia or individuals who hear voices and that's associated with anxiety or suspiciousness will often cut themselves off from other people.
Give us some sense of what we're talking about here. What are the statistics if somebody does have in their teens, let's say, some psychotic events, they hear voices, they see things? That doesn't mean, of course, that they've gone into full-blown schizophrenia. From that population, how many do go on to full-blown schizophrenia where that is their reality? And can you, with intervention when somebody has psychotic events, can you stop that full-blown schizophrenia?
Well, schizophrenia is a diagnosis of duration of symptoms. So the first answer is that 3 out of 100 people will experience psychosis in their lifetime. 1 out of 100 will have schizophrenia. So that illustrates that there are, you know, episodes of psychosis that have nothing
right.
to do with going on to become schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is when the symptoms last for 6 months or longer, and there's also an accompanying decline in functioning.
And is it your sense that in intervening with people who have those psychotic moments, you can perhaps reduce the number that go on to have the long-term schizophrenia?
To have a different version of schizophrenia. One thing we do say is we tell people really to forget what you know about schizophrenia. There's an inclination to, when someone has a good outcome with schizophrenia, to say, well, that must not have been schizophrenia in the first place. And that's not how we think about it. So I think that we can make a difference in terms of improving the trajectory of schizophrenia. And in that case, it doesn't need to look as severe or have the, you know, itinerant social functioning issues.
What are you hearing from the families who didn't know about this? You know, we're hearing that there could have been intervention. What are you hearing from families for whom this is too late?
Yeah. Well, we say it's never too late, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't a loss. That's what we hear. We hear that we've lost our child. We've lost the child we knew. Initially, you hear, you know, are they going to get married? Are they going to go back to college? then you hear, you know, wait a minute, I would be just happy if I saw him smile again.
So that underscores, I'm sure for you, the importance of this early intervention.
Absolutely. With early intervention, I mean, we see tremendous successes. You know, it's great to be able to see someone manage symptoms better, come to an awareness that they can hear voices and still have a rewarding life.
Corinne Kather is a cognitive behavioral therapist at the First Episode and Early Psychosis Program at Mass General Hospital here in the Boston area. By the way, Dr. Kather, we're talking about Boston. How much is this repeated across the country, this program, this thinking?
Well, right now, actually, the National Institutes of Mental Health has funded a huge initiative to investigate the optimal treatment package in first episode psychosis. And there are probably 40 or so centers at least participating in this kind of research. So this is actually right now we're really on the cusp, hopefully, of something great and of really changing our healthcare system.
Dr. Kather, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Japan, the traditional sport of sumo wrestling, you know, those huge guys in tiny outfits rumbling around, is trying to restore its reputation after a scandal over illegal betting by some of the wrestlers. The scandal actually exposed what are longtime ties between the sport and Japan's notorious gang members, the Yakuza. Now, as the BBC's Roland Burke reports from Tokyo, sumo wrestling is caught up in a wider police crackdown on organized crime in Japan.
Now, if you've ever wondered how sumo wrestlers build up their great bulk and power, you need to come to a restaurant like this one. And this restaurant, they sell chankonabe, which is the pork meatballs and vegetable stew on a miso soup base that wrestlers eat in vast quantities. And like many of these restaurants, this one is run by a former sumo wrestler, Kotonofuji Oyakata, and pictures of him on the wall show him in his prime. So those two wrestlers in that picture look a bit mismatched in terms of size. Are you the big guy or the small guy? So you're the small guy?
After a lifetime in sumo, the allegations of the sport's link to Yakuza gangsters are no surprise to Kotonofuji Oyakata.
It's natural. It's show business. They organize show business. Even in traditional kabuki theater, there is a famous character, a sumo wrestler, who becomes a yakuza. So the link has always been there.
Now, to the consternation of fans watching training in a sumo stable, those links have been thrust into the public eye. The sport may be brutal. The wrestlers batter tree trunks or each other, but the public expects them to maintain a degree of decorum. But Japan's top wrestler has been expelled and many more were suspended over illegal betting organized by gangster middlemen, and the police are investigating.
The sumo scandal is one battle in the National Police Agency's war on organized crime. It's a war, so there's going to be casualties. Sumo is going to be one of the casualties.
Jake Adelstein wrote Tokyo Vice, an American reporter on the police beat in Japan.
The Yakuza represent traditional Japanese values: honor, loyalty, reciprocity, endurance, obedience. The Yakuza have portrayed themselves as the people who are preserving those values. And in that sense, they're kind of admired. And in order for the police to really drum up support for new laws, which would allow them to really crack down on the Yakuza, they needed to show they're doing something awful. And to take Japan's national sport and turn it into a scandal-ridden entity, that doesn't sit well with the Japanese people.
It's in Japan's red light districts that the Yakuza have made much of their money, branching out into kickbacks and stock market manipulation. They have business cards and corporate-style headquarters and have been largely tolerated. Fan magazines have been published, especially about the biggest gang, the Yamaguchi Gumi, 40,000 strong. But last year, gangsters went too far by sitting in the VIP seats at a sumo tournament to cheer up a gang boss watching in prison on TV. It was the final provocation for the National Police Agency. Kohei Kishi heads the organized crime department.
The The Yamaguchi Gumi is growing rapidly these days and makes up almost half the whole Yakuza population. It has a great influence on other Yakuza groups. Unless we clash Yamaguchi Gumi, we cannot hit whole Yakuza world, so we are concentrating on clashing the Yamaguchi Gumi.
At the sumo stable, the wrestlers are keeping up with their training. The sport is beginning the long process of restoring its reputation by cutting ties to organized crime. The Yakuza are no longer welcome, and surveillance cameras are being used at the autumn tournament to try to keep them out of the audience.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. And speaking of sumo wrestling, tomorrow we'll check in on that wild governor's race in New York. And you think sumo wrestling is tough? Try Fancy's competition for pastry chefs. That's tomorrow. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. What happens when an actor decides to turn the camera on the paparazzi? Well, for one thing, he starts to like how it feels. Adrien Grenier plays the megastar Vincent Chase on the HBO show Entourage. So in both his work, playing a celebrity, and in his real life, being one, he's fodder for the packs of photographers who are a fixture in Hollywood. But what started as his project to document and try to understand the celebrity paparazzi culture became a little more complicated when he decided to focus on the youngest among them, then 13-year-old paparazzo Austin Viscadyke.
I saw that kid, and I'm looking at this kid like, hey, man, it's like 2 in the morning. What are you doing out here? Shouldn't you be studying?
I was just like, who's this kid, and why is he with the paparazzi?
He answers me with a click, click.
Is he a legitimate guy who gets pictures himself?
He's a streetwise guy.
Any action?
I think that kid's smart. I wish I would have been making that much money when I was a teenager.
That was celebrity tracker Perez, not Paris Hilton. Before him, Rosie O'Donnell, Lindsay Lohan, Mario Lopez, just some of the voices in the new documentary, Teenage Paparazzo. It premieres tonight on HBO, and we want to spend some time today with the film's director and on-camera guide, Adrien Grenier. He joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Austin, this 13, 14-year-old, when you start filming, incredibly precocious, sort of a blonde Justin Bieber, you know, with the hair.
He's got the swoop.
The swoop. Fierce in his dedication, staying up all night tracking celebrities. What was your reaction when you first met him?
Shock. Pretty much just disbelief. I couldn't believe that there was this little boy who is so cute and innocent, was vying for the photos amongst these big, burly, smelly paparazzi.
Yeah, and we see, you know, we've all feel we've seen paparazzi, but we really are in the middle of the pack in your film. I mean, you really see the violent jostling and tearing off after people. In fact, here's a scene where Austin chases after Paris Hilton. He tells a cab, you know, really, follow that car.
Paris! Hey, chase that car. Chase her. Catch up to that car on the right. This is her right here. Is that Nikki? No. Just stay on her ass. She's turning. She's going in and out. Holy.
So, Adrien,
the language.
Yeah, the language and the violence. I'm thinking at this point, someone's going to get killed. And one of the people in the film, I think it is Paris Hilton, mentions Princess Diana and this idea of, you know, photographers chasing a car. Here you've got this 13-year-old doing it.
Yeah. I guess the danger is highlighted when there's a young boy involved, and suddenly that reality becomes more extreme.
Well, and some of the celebrities you talk to are wondering, you know, where are his parents? And someone in our office was thinking, you know you have a problem when Paris Hilton starts moralizing. Let's listen.
I always see him. He's always outside Mr. Chow's or just outside my house. So I say hi to him. He's so young and cute. Isn't he like 14 years old?
Yes.
His mom isn't upset that he does that.
She's giving him the freedom to explore his world, mm-hmm. and his options.
At 3 a.m.
That's you talking to Paris Hilton, and you meet his mom and his dad. His dad is concerned about what Austin does, his mom not so much. But here's where we start to see almost this symbiotic, you know, yeah, kids are concerned about this 13-year-old, but you see how much the stars kind of like it. You kind of like it. You're working with this 13-year-old. He adores you, looks up to you. It's almost like we're watching this web being woven around everybody, you know, held tightly together by these photographers.
That's what I discovered through making the film, that it was all about storytelling, this smorgasbord of images and pictures and reflections. And everybody's contributing on some level, and everybody's gaining. It's this dance of voyeurs and exhibitionists, and that's at the end of the day really what it became. And Austin, of course, is right there in the mix. That's what he sees. That's what has influenced him. And, you know, even I, maybe especially I, being a celebrity who became a celebrity by playing a celebrity on a show about celebrity, is going to have a certain influence on him.
Well, and he on you. I mean, he wants to be like you. He, you know, you can see at some points in the film that you're kind of liking this, kind of mm-hmm. kind of like a kid brother, but you're not his brother. You're a documentary filmmaker, and it, you can see it also start to change, where you suddenly realize, wait a minute, he expected this. I thought I was making a film on this kid. This kid thinks that I'm going to clue him into where celebrities are.
I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Oh, never mind. It's fine.
Tell me.
No, I thought that you were, like, going to call me and, like, tell me where you were sometimes. But it's cool.
You mean for photos?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I thought I was going to tip you off?
Yeah, I have had celebrities do that.
Who?
I can't name names.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, when you are examining this topic and you are, you do get lost in this hall of mirrors and reflections, and for so long I'm trying to guide him, quite ironically, trying to show him how to find more meaning in his experience. But there I was, you know, indulging myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think when you are lost in these reflections, very often you end up staring right back at yourself and having to recognize the influence that you do have.
And this is the other thing about documentary filmmakers. You know, are you just there as a human camera? Are you supposed to manipulate the reality? You know, suddenly Austin starts almost getting too big for you. You know, he doesn't want you around.
Go over there, please.
Sorry?
Go over there, please.
Where?
I don't want them to see you from me, so go over there. Can you just move like 4 steps over? Like, keep going, like, there.
Don't get out of the car. Film me from across the street.
I have to get down because these are all cops.
Well, why do you have to get down?
Because I can't be seen in this car.
Why not?
Because they know you're with Adrian.
No, they don't.
They do.
He feels that your cameras are messing up his work. He's maybe even got bigger fish to fry. He's going off. He's on the morning shows. And what do you want? What's happening? What are you thinking then?
You know, I was really nervous that I was going to lose my subject, that he was going to disappear from the project. And I found myself catering to him and walking on eggshells and doing everything I could to keep him engaged, which really wasn't my initial intention. My intention was to try and figure out what was possessing this kid to do such a disdainful thing, and maybe he shouldn't be doing it and he should stop. And then there I was, encouraging him to continue.
Yeah, and kind of getting like, hey, wait a minute, I'm Adrian Grenier. Why are you going off with these other guys? That is Adrian Grenier, the star of HBO's Entourage. This is that show's theme song. He's now also director of the new documentary, Teenage Paparazzo. When we come back, what is it like to join the paparazzi pack? That's in 1 minute, here and now. We've been speaking with actor Adrian Grenier. His new documentary, Teenage Paparazzo, is a look at the real-life celebrity culture that's celebrated in his hit HBO show Entourage, in which he plays superstar Vincent Chase.
Hey, so Vince, let me ask you, was that seahorse you rode animatronic or computer-generated?
Animatronic.
Animatronic. Yes, you owe me 20.
A clip from Entourage. And Adrian, before the break, we were seeing how celebrity is made up of concentric circles, everyone using everyone else. Austin, the 13-year-old paparazzo, is your subject in your documentary. You're using him, but he's becoming famous and he wants to use you, suggesting maybe you should go on a date with Paris Hilton so he could get the shot.
Right, exactly.
And you did it.
I did do it. I gave it to him. I gave him the tip-off he'd been looking for, and at the same time was able to highlight how easy it is to create stories in this tabloid, I guess, art form? I don't know.
No, not art form. Look for a better word.
tabloid industry.
Yeah, well.
I say art because it is storytelling, you know. I mean, it is, and I look at Paris Hilton, and I think there's an artistry to what she does.
Which is what? Just make herself available for cameras, really.
Create stories. When she walks out of her house, she's performing. She's on. Paparazzi depend on celebrities to give it up, to give them something to photograph. Most celebrities, when they're not working, when they're not performing, they want to go back to their normal, everyday mundanity. But Paris is working. She's there to create the stories. And I think Andy Warhol would have been very proud.
Yeah.
You know, she plays with this art form, I guess, that her canvas being tabloid.
Well, so you decide to pick up the camera and try it yourself.
Where are the binoculars?
You guys have binoculars?
Rick.
Hold on.
I'm with a couple people and they'd like to find some celebrities. It's kind of like a tour.
Also have some shields.
Run!
I could feel the excitement all around me. I ran to where there was a clear view and started firing. I couldn't make a judgment about the paparazzi till I tried it myself. I had to put myself in their shoes. And once I did, I realized that, oh my, this is it. This is why they do it, because there was so much excitement and the adrenaline's pumping. It tickles this animal instinct, this desire for the hunt, the chase.
During a certain part of this, I'm watching and I'm thinking, wow. To these people, it feels as if, you know, people racing here and there and elbowing each other out of the way in this tiny little postage stamp, really, of the world. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, you tell me, it sounds like that when you're in it, you think this is the most important thing. But meanwhile, for those of us watching, you know, we're thinking again, why aren't people chasing after Nobel Prize winners, you know?
The genre is different. It's a very superficial soundbite type of media. I actually interviewed Noam Chomsky for the film, and I gotta say, didn't give a lot of sound bites. you really have to listen to what he's saying, and you have to take the time and put forth the effort to understand it.
And as a result, he's not in the film.
He didn't make it.
No. Nope.
Looking for the right sound bite. I mean, he was great. He gave me, I mean, we did talk about the fact that he, on some level, is my hero. And he quickly scolded me and said, you know, I'm not your hero, I'm not a celebrity, I'm just a guy who has something to say, and that's the point, you know.
Why, by the way, might Noam Chomsky be your hero?
He helped to cultivate the way I looked at corporate media and corporate America in general and gained perspective on the American dream. And also being a, you know, young, rebellious guy myself, looking for truth and fighting against tyranny. He sort of was my role model.
Well, and you also read a book that changed your life and got to speak to the author in the film. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I read a book called Mediated by Thomas DeZengotita, which basically changed my life. It was almost like the Matrix being revealed to me. After reading the book, I suddenly saw how media is influencing all of us, laid out before me very clearly, to the point where I was able to navigate suddenly through this web.
Yeah, you're like a cursor, you know, like on a computer. You just let yourself, your body, travel through, and you gathered the content from the media as you went.
Exactly, and I could cull stories. I could conjure them because of who I am, because of the fact that I have a certain celebrity. So I was on Dr. Phil talking about paparazzi, and I figured instead of just talking about the perils of paparazzi and, you know, via narration or through an interview, why not take from a show, Dr. Phil, which is basically tabloid in its own way, why not infiltrate that in order to get the message across? Yeah.
So people who have shows, they're using you used them back.
Yeah.
You went to Fenway Park? I happened to be at that game.
You were at that game.
When suddenly the cameras cut away.
It's time now for the fan of the game brought to you by Pepsi. It's Adrian Grenier from Entourage.
We're like, what's going on, you know?
You gossiped about me.
I did, yeah. Actually. So I was a part of your film.
Yeah.
Didn't know it. But I'm wondering, too, because what we see when you go to Fenway Park is how well-known you are and how well-liked you are. And people come up to you from every corner, and most of them are drunk.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder, you're doing something very admirable in trying to, you know, as you say, hold up this mirror. But did you also have to ask yourself, geez, how would I feel if I walked through Fenway Park and no one knew me?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's something that you have to wrestle with. Anyone who's famous has to deal with that fame thing, and not only has to reconcile all of this attention, but also has to deal with the potential that it could be gone.
Well, but it seems like one of the things you're also saying in the film is it's beautiful. You get to mock this culture, but you also mock yourself because you recognize that you like it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I do like it. And I guess what I've found to be very fulfilling is not the fame thing. Being famous has not fulfilled me, but having something that I worked very hard at for the past 3 years and being able to share that with people is really what has brought me a great deal of happiness and security. And I guess at the end of the day, I would say go ahead and vie for fame, see what you can do, try and get it. And if you can, have something worth them paying attention to.
Yeah, once you get there. Well, we don't want to give away the ending because it's terrific. And like all good Homeric stories, you know, it has a character that we followed all along and they make a choice, mm-hmm. you know, at the end. So people need to see it to see what happened to Austin. But meantime, do you at all worry about the next time you walk down the street in Los Angeles? I mean, what do you anticipate?
You know, this has been a very empowering experience for me. And now when I see the paparazzi, not only do I know many of their names, so I can say, Joe, you know, cut it out, all right? You know, and they tend to listen. The minute you know someone, they become less scary. I'm really hoping that it'll provide an alternative to how they treat celebrities and how celebrities can embrace paparazzi. You know, I really made a point to show the human side of both so that the paparazzi aren't these faceless, lurking monsters hiding in the bushes, and celebrities aren't just paychecks.
Adrian Grenier, his new documentary is Teenage Paparazzo. It premieres on HBO tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern and ends with this song by Lady Gaga. Adrian Grenier, thank you.
Thanks for having me.